you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPFW, Washington, D.C.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW, Washington. And welcome to this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. 47 years going strong because you, the listener, support this public broadcasting community-based radio station by your financial wherewithal and social connectivity. And for that, I thank you. For new listeners, We the People is a hourly news magazine on Wednesdays that looks at race, politics, history, and culture, particularly how they intersect and affect our everyday issues. There are folks from the past, folks from the present, and I'm sure folks in the future who apply themselves in these areas to help us with our mission of building better communities, at least one broadcast at a time. To do that today, we have Dr. Margaret A. Hagerman. Dr. Hagerman is the Associate Professor of Sociology and Faculty Affiliate in African American Studies and Gender Studies at Mississippi State University. She's also the author of White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America, and her current and new book, Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America, is the topic of our conversation. Kids are at the center of today's culture wars. Many different adults are debating what they should be allowed to learn, particularly regarding racism. And yet, no one asks kids what they think about these issues. Dr. Hagerman amplifies the voices of children who grew up during Trump's first presidency and explores how they learn about race. She interviewed nearly 50 children aged 10 to 13 in two different political landscapes and discovered remarkably similar patterns. Racism, she asserts, is not just a local or regional phenomenon. It is a broad American project affecting childhoods across the country. She offers concrete examples of the kinds of interventions that are necessary to help kids learn how to become members of a multiracial democracy and avoid the development of a far-right thinking in white youth of today. Dr. Hagerman, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, David, for inviting me on your program.
Well, you're more than welcome. Tell us a little bit more about this research that you did so people understand the background, and then we'll talk about your discipline for a moment.
Sure. So I am a sociologist, and I'm really interested in how children learn race and learn racism. Most of my work has looked at white children just because there hasn't really been a lot of research in this area. And I think, we know the importance of the, parents raising kids of color, how they talk to their children about surviving racism in America. We don't know very much, though, about how these white kids who are also growing up in the US, how they are developing their ideas about race and the kinds of messages they're receiving, how they're making sense of them. And so my work broadly is focused on trying to get some actual information about the lived experiences of young people today and how they are processing not only race and the polarizing nature of debates about race in this country, but also politics. I don't think you can really separate out politics and race in the United States. And so this new book that I've written has tried to incorporate, what kids are thinking about both of these things and how they connect.
And with the study itself, when did it occur? What regions did you look at? What categories of youth would you tell us were involved?
Yeah, so because of my focus on thinking about politics, I wanted to make sure that the children that I interviewed were growing up in places that were both similar to one another in some ways. Like I wanted kids to be in communities that had both, more right-leaning folks and left-leaning folks, registered Republicans and Democrats. But I also wanted to look at places that had very different state-level political landscapes. And so the two states that I chose were Mississippi and Massachusetts. And I think it's obvious how different those places are at the state level. But certainly at the local level, I chose communities that had, again, a pretty equal split between, folks that were sort of identifying with different political parties. And so I interviewed children that were growing up in families that were very conservative. I interviewed children that were growing up in families that were very, progressive and politically liberal. And so, and obviously kids in between too. But I, did this research during 2017 to 2019. So it was the beginning of Trump's first presidency. I was really curious about, that moment and how kids were making sense of things going on in their schools, the headlines, how are they processing all of this? Because that moment, it might not seem like it right now, but that moment was pretty different from, what they had been used to prior, which was the Obama administration. And so I was just really curious about that particular moment and how kids were processing it. So yeah, I had 45 children. They were all in middle school. Middle school is a really fascinating time to talk to kids. I think we spend a lot of time talking to older kids, but I think there's a lot going on in those middle school years. And certainly child development literature supports my argument here that, we've got to pay attention to what's happening when kids are 10, 11, 12, starting to develop political and ideological notions about the country they live in.
And needless to say, not to falsely reduce things, but it's a time that they're very emotive. Emotions are a big factor for them, let's say. Okay.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And just further, people are wondering how such interviews are conducted. One thing that I noticed from your book is the importance of the people who assisted you. I wouldn't call them native to the area, but they're familiar. They have a commonality with the populations that you studied. Is that correct?
Yes. So I had two incredible research assistants, Kimberly Mason and Courtney Heath, who both graduate students are both from Mississippi. I am not from Mississippi. And though I have lived in Mississippi for nearly a decade, I am still reminded every day by people that you are not from here, the way I talk, the way I am, and so I have struggled, honestly, to build rapport with, families in this region, for lots of reasons that I could talk about. But the great thing about Courtney and Kimberly is they both are from here. And so they were able to sort of build that rapport with folks and parents. I mean, interviewing children requires permission from parents and trust and, things of that nature. And so they were able to not only build those relationships, but also interpret the data with, you know, attention paid to the local context. Courtney is a white woman, and she grew up in a family that was, you know, similar to some of the ones in the study. And then Kimberly is a Black woman, and she, you know, was able to talk to Black children in a way that, you know, I need to be careful. I'm a white woman, and, you know, I don't want to make Black children feel uncomfortable making, you know, asking them to talk to the strange white lady about racism, you know? So I gave children the choice. Some of the kids did choose to be interviewed by me, some of the Black children, but Kimberly helped me out a lot with that. So in the Mississippi context, their assistance was great. I'm from Massachusetts, and I actually did a slightly different recruitment strategy in Massachusetts. I used an after-school program to help generate the sample, and as well as some other snowball sampling. So I wasn't able to have that kind of help there, but I did my best, and I talk about that in the methodological appendix a little bit if people are interested in learning more.
And design of the book, the execution of the book, is quite helpful to the reader, particularly the chapter headings. One of them is a common phrase that the kids are not all right, which means you're trying to engage in their mindset and the environment they're dealing with. Is there anything you want to tell us about the general frame of mind, the mindset, the psychology, the sentiments, et cetera, that these youth that you engaged, you interviewed, have? Are they generally seeing the world as a safe place, as a troubled place, as a chaotic place, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, this is one of the questions I was really interested in seeing, you know, seeing what the kids had to say. The children were all, and I talk about this in great detail, were all very scared. They all had different kinds of fears. And by all the children, I should point out that I had children in both regions, both communities, who spanned the racial, you know, divisions and also class divisions. And so I had children who had, you know, different lived experiences, but they mapped into three groups. And I can talk more about those three groups later. But in general, what was so fascinating to me is that whether they loved Trump, hated Trump, whether they thought some of the things happening in society involving racism were bad, whether they thought they were fine, regardless, these kids express different kinds of fear. And so I talk about that fear a lot in this book, and how that fear, I argue, is underlying a lot of the other emotions that they express. Obviously, that fear is about different aspects of what was going on in that moment, either feeling victimized in certain ways, or feeling the need to protect something that people, they believed was belonged to them. Whatever it might be, fear really was, I think, the underlying emotion, and helped me kind of frame the book.
Well, early in the book, you talk about something you label the Trump effect. Can you really tell us about that? What is it?
Sure. So that's language I borrowed from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Other folks were using that language around 2016. I mean, it really started with Trump's candidacy and running for office, and the kind of rhetoric that he was using the first time. We could talk about the second time, but this book is about the first time. And so the Southern Poverty Law Center published a report that found that 90% of the teachers that they surveyed indicated that their school climate was negatively impacted by Trump's election. I was really kind of curious about, or his campaign, I should say, and his election. We heard reports, if you recall, of kids chanting "build the wall" at schools. We saw all kinds of racist images on Snapchat and other kinds of social media that young people use. And so there was a lot of concern back in 2016, 2017 about, you know, what's going on with these kids. That's where I got the term from. And then one of the things I tried to do in the book is characterize and document everything I could find about research related to the impact that Trump's first presidency had on children and youth in America. And so I kind of run through, I tried to find every possible study and try to really document all of the different ways, you know, whatever you think about Trump, like these are, this is research, right? This is what we found was the impact of these policies on young people. What I try to highlight is that the vast majority of that research is focused on children of color and children from other marginalized groups, LGBT kids, children who are Muslim children. There was lots of discussion at that time about those particular groups of kids for obvious reasons. They were being targeted and their families. But what I point out in the book is that there's very little, hardly any research on white children at that time. And what were these white kids up to, particularly those who were the perpetrators of some of this racist violence against their peers. So that's sort of, you know, the way I think about the Trump effect. And then my intervention is, well, what do we not know about that moment? And where can I kind of step in and try to offer some empirical evidence and some theorizing about it?
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Margaret Hagerman, who's the Associate Professor of Sociology, Faculty Affiliate in African American Studies and Gender Studies at Mississippi State University. You're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM. I'm your host, David Whetstone. And the topic at hand in this hour is Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America. You've mentioned and both explicitly alluded to what the research found out and what it didn't find out. Maybe we should take a moment and also say, in your practice of sociology, what's important to keep in mind? What are you trying to talk to us about in this hour and through your book?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think a lot of people aren't always exactly clear what sociology is. And so certainly my students that I'm teaching right now, you know, first couple weeks of the semester here and teaching big intro classes. But, you know, what I'm interested in is drawing connections between big macro level structural arrangements in our society, things to do with the economy and politics and education, with things that are happening at the individual micro level. What is the link between those things? How are individual kids' lives shaped by these broader structural arrangements and patterns? And so obviously kids are also part of groups. They're part of all kinds of groups, but in this book, I'm focused on their membership in racial groups. And so I'm curious in my research broadly, you know, in this book, of course, as well, about how it is that children are learning what it means to be a member of the group that this racialized group to which they belong. We live, you know, sociologists argue, we live in a society structured by the placement of people into these racial groups, and these groups are organized in a hierarchy, and power is distributed along that hierarchy. And so I want to know, how are kids learning all this? How are they making sense of it? And also, how does growing up in a racialized society like ours, and a, you know, to be clear, a racially unequal society like ours, how does that shape the perceptions they have, the experiences they have, you know, the kinds of schools they go to, and then the messages that they receive about, you know, do they belong? You know, are they going to be a leader? There's all kinds of different things we could talk about. But a sociological perspective on racial learning in childhood is trying to take into account the larger social context that is shaping young people's lives today.
So that being said, here's the most basic question to start off with. You think America is indeed a racist country, or a country with many races, or something else?
Yeah, so when I did my first book that you mentioned, White Kids, that was research that was conducted during the Obama years, 2011 to 2013. Some of the kids in that study said, yes, America is racist. Some, and all the kids in the study were white. Some of the white kids in that first study said, no, we are no longer racism. You know, it was typical kind of colorblind way of thinking. Look, we have a black president. You know, look, racism is over. Racism was around back in the old days, right? However, what's interesting from my perspective as a scholar and as just a human being is that when I did the second study and talk to kids, different kids, but of the same, you know, age group, et cetera, not one child told me that America is no longer racist. The thing that was different, we still had lots of kids that were saying, yes, it is, and here's examples, et cetera. I also had children of color in the second study that all of them, you know, said, yes, America's racist. The difference were these other white children who said, yes, it's racist, but I don't care. It's fine. Racism is fine. There's no big deal. And so that to me was the big difference between the, you know, 2011 data and the 2017 data, was these children who literally are saying, actually, yes, we do have racism, but I don't care about it. So that's sort of the general view, I guess, from this data, is that these children are aware that they're growing up in a society that is racially unequal. It's just how they respond to that knowledge that I think is very different depending on the kid and the group that they belong to.
I think that both sociology in your book in particular and your work in particular offers a very important and useful element to all this that's going on. And that is, when we dive deeper into how kids are learning about race and racism, there's some important touch points that sociology offers. Needless to say, your book introduces the concept of kids feeling race. I'd like you to break that out as fully as you like, please.
Sure. Yes. So usually when we think about emotions, we think about them in a psychological way, right? That these are aspects of the interior. These are things that are, you know, happening at the individual level. They're how we're each, you know, in our own brains privately thinking about things and responding to things and how we feel. Certainly there's a lot of important research and writings about different theories of emotions and so on and so forth that come out of a more psychological focus. Where I try to come into this discussion is thinking about a sociological understanding of emotions. And I draw on the work of a number of scholars, in particular, Eduardo Bonilla Silva, who's a leading race scholar in the United States right now, professor at Duke. And his work, you know, he had an address that he gave to the entire American Sociological Association about this concept back in 2018 about racialized emotions and how sociologists cannot just ignore emotions as we're trying to make sense of inequality in America. And so I took his call seriously and I tried to read as much as I could about this concept. And the thing that I think is so useful about racialized emotions from the sociological perspective is that it allows us to take into account the ways that emotions are socially acquired, that it's not just our own individual response to things that is shaping how we feel. It's our membership in these groups and how our groups interact with one another, how our entire society is set up from the beginning. And one of the things that, you know, Eduardo talks about and other folks have talked about is that kids feel, right, you know, that they remember even themselves as being people of color feeling race before they even had the language to talk about it. That is a racialized emotion, right, is feeling this thing that exists in society even before you have sort of this logic or ideological narrative that can kind of explain it. And so what I'm trying to do in this work is take seriously, you talked about kids at this age as being very emotive. That is true. And, you know, part of what I am arguing in this research is that those emotions are not just kids having random emotions. Those are kids who are learning to feel, right? They're feeling race, whether they're white children who are learning to feel race in a way that leads to them being quite hateful towards children of color, whether that's feelings of being scared that your family is going to be mistreated by the government because of, you know, their own racial or ethnic identity. Those are all examples of how our emotions and how we feel are shaped by the larger arrangement of things in our society. So, you know, this is a complicated theory. There's lots more to it. But to me, I think the key takeaway is that emotions have a connection to the larger structure, how things are arranged. They're socially acquired, as I said. So one of the things I looked for in this research were patterns across the kids with regard to their emotions as they pertain to race. And sure enough, I found these really clear patterns. I didn't go in looking for these patterns. These patterns emerged that, sure enough, mapped onto racial groups, you know, and how people are experiencing race and then how they feel race. And then I argue how they then learn race.
And so the observations have an insistence that even in the two regions, this is where you get the similar patterns.
Absolutely.
And with that, Just want to use a little strategic amplification and reiteration here. So a young person, a kid, will say or feel, aha, something's going on here. That's one level. The other level is what us adults would rush to then, identifying it as happy, sad, mad, angry, fearful, etc. I'm thinking of current events, current affairs right now. And when schools, when teachers in particular try to engage this, there's been a lot of trouble. We can all picture, if we've been aware of the news, the angry parent at the school board meeting or the incident at school X, either between kids or what an administrator does or does not do. What is it that sociology offers in the midst of this? Not so much the how-to, even though that's very important, obviously, but what is this extra sense of understanding, let's say? I'm kind of freighting the question.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you think about these white parents at school board meetings, it's not one white parent at a school board meeting throwing a fit because they want things done their way. And, you know, this is something that we're seeing happen across the country. I mean, I have a book over there about called School Moms. It's about documenting this as like a social movement connected to previous social movements around parents' rights and things of this nature. What I think is interesting is that those parents are expressing a certain kind of emotion, but they're part of the same group, right? They're doing social, they're acting in the world, the social world, in a way to advance what they perceive to be their own group's position. They are advancing what they perceive to be, and I don't agree with them, but what they perceive to be good for their white children. So this isn't just about some person having an emotional outburst at a meeting. This is about, you know, a political agenda, and emotions are being used.
Policies.
Yeah, exactly.
Decisions. Yeah.
Exactly. So that's where I actually do think that racialized emotions is so helpful in understanding the motivations behind some of these behaviors that we see that we might be, you know, surprised about, but that, you know, there's something deeper going on here. And that's what I find with these kids too.
And of course, it's not only the issue of what kids acquire, how in the world are they navigating all this activity around them? And also, how are they viewed as participants or respected as human beings being in these situations?
Exactly.
We're talking to Dr. Margaret A. Hagerman. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at Mississippi State University. The topic of our conversation here at We the People is Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America. We have a lot more to discuss. But in service to you, the listener, possibly and probably the supporter of WPFW, we're going to offer some public service announcements and ask you to stick with us and be right back after this.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. In commemoration of International Women's Day, the programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, again at your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. I and more than 80 programmers bring you music and jazz and justice and all that's in between, of course. But importantly, the programmers make their shows available not only through our archives at WPFWFM.org, but on various social media platforms like iTunes and other media platforms that you properly use. Importantly, we do all this because you, the listener, choose to support us through 47 years. Next month, we'll be going into our 48th year, and I want to thank you especially. not only in this hour, but there's great programming that's offered on Wednesdays at 3 Eastern, Sophie's Parlor, one of the oldest women's collectives, bringing you arts and music and culture by women before everyone. That's again at 3 o'clock Eastern. And then at 2, Zen El Amin focuses concerns on Middle Eastern affairs with Shea Wanana. At 1, Africa Now with host Mumiza Mutali, engaging things that involved African-descended people, not only in the continent, but throughout the diaspora. All that is made possible by you, the listener, and we thank you for that. Our guest today is Margaret A. Hagerman. She is Associate Professor of Sociology, Faculty Affiliate in African American Studies and Gender Studies at Mississippi State University. The topic of our conversation is her current book, Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America. Dr. Hagerman, thank you for being with us. We talked about the setting, the political landscape that young people are in. Let's really honor this point that their voices need to be amplified. People need to listen to them and really, in turn, care about them. How do they really deal with racism? One of the notions that comes up is color blindness. That seems to be the current fashion in most of our society in dealing with race.
Sure. So the kids that were expressing what we would call colorblind ideology, this notion that, you know, America is no longer racist, racial inequality has been resolved, whatever. Those kids were the ones that were the white children who were very surprised that Trump was elected in 2017. These were kids that were actually horrified that he was elected. And part of why they were so horrified was because his election and the fact that enough people, you know, supported him that he was elected, disrupted their sense that America is colorblind. These children perceived him as an individual racist person, which, you know, within a colorblind framework, sometimes that's what happens, right? People are like, oh, there's a couple of racist people out there, but overall things are pretty good. So for those children to see him, you know, a person that they did identify as racist, be put into a position of power, that really shattered their sense of America and, you know, living in this country. But what I sort of, one of the pieces of this argument is, you know, are these children so horrified that they're motivated to pair up with their peers who are already, you know, fighting for racial justice and join the efforts? Or are they kids that say, well, you know what, as soon as Trump is out of office, things go back to normal? And so what I found is that for the vast majority of the white children who really hated Trump and were like horrified that he was elected, most of them said, but it's okay. Once he's out of office, things will be fine. There were a handful of white children, though, who were fundamentally, you know, their worldviews were completely changed. And they actually, their parents told me even later, got involved in, you know, joining with peers of color in doing kinds of, you know, racial justice work in their local communities. And so, you know, there were a few children that colorblindness did not prevail. But for that group of white children who were horrified by Trump, they really were, you know, committed to thinking in a colorblind way.
Notwithstanding that, I wanted to make it clear, and hopefully I'm not misinterpreting you or your book, but even the kids who are very much in favor of Mr. Trump or pro-Trump believe that he was a racist. Most of the kids you interviewed believe that. Am I correct in that?
Yes, I think almost every child said, or they would say things like, he's kind of racist. He's racist some days, you know, but yes, all the children across the different three different groups that I looked at.
So would that make a sense of a difference with, I guess, what we could call racial discomfort or racial disgust? Is, in other words, what I'm trying to get at is there are certainly marked differences between the youth you interviewed, the parents, their parents, and the communities that they're in. In other words, they're their own persons, I'm glad to say.
Yes. Yes, I mean, the racial disgust is the emotion that was expressed by especially those white children who were shocked that Trump was elected. Racial disgust was not what was on display for the white children who were happy that Trump was elected. There were different emotions that those kids expressed. And in fact, one of the things that I explore deeply is pleasure and joy and happiness and what I describe as the emotions of dominance, feeling good that, you know, this person that quote unquote would advance their own, you know, best interests was in office. But in terms of those white children whose, you know, worlds were kind of shattered when he was elected, they were disgusted. Again, though, that disgust didn't always lead to them then taking action to try to change the world around them. It rather, you know, kind of just reverted back to what it had been before.
We were talking about all sorts of emotions, and what you just described is both a positive and negative racial solidarity. But you were, earlier in our conversation, you mentioned racial fear. And again, I'm trying to temper, even within this interview, the adult projections of what kids are and what they do. But out of that fear, there was not a totally positive outcome, but something that was helpful between kids.
In terms of solidarity?
Yes.
Yes. So, right. So the first group of kids that I look at are these white children who were horrified by Trump being elected. The second group of children that I look at were the kids of color. And these are, I use the term kids of color purposefully to be ambiguous because there were kids from different racial, you know, they identified themselves in different ways. But adult language would be, you know, Black, Latino kids, some mixed race children. All of the children of color that I interviewed in both Mississippi and Massachusetts, you know, did not support Trump, and they were also horrified. But the difference between, you know, the second group and the first group is that they were committed to joining together, not, you know, in different ways. You know, some of the children, I talk a lot about how some of the kids are really committed to learning as much as they can about Black history, that Black history is something that they feel like will give them tools that they can use to advocate for themselves and others in the future. Whereas other kids want to join in protests and do more, you know, sort of a get out on the street kind of thing and demanding change. So there's different versions of this, but the children of color, you know, yes, they were angry and scared and had a lot of emotions related to policies and things that Trump was saying about people just like them at that moment. But it's the righteous anger that they had, which I think is different than like the racist, you know, angry Black kid kind of, you know, stereotype. But this righteous anger motivated them in many cases to want to do things to make their future country better, and to challenge what they viewed as oppression and injustice today. So the racial solidarity comes about where kids are even across different racial groups. So like many of the Black children talked about how scared they were for their Latino peers because they saw a sort of a shared destiny, you know, with these different kids. So I try to talk about, it was a lot of data there, but I try to weave it all together to make a clear case that these emotions lead to action. That's why emotions are so important to understand, is that they lead to action, you know, and you can decide if the action is good or bad. That's your, you know, people's own call. But I think these racialized emotions are underlying how people think and then how they behave in the world.
In one way, these kids kind of indict adults in their lives, quite frankly. Your book demonstrates that even when they're left alone or in isolated groups, there's a whole sense of community and living with each other that, just to be frank, I think even people who run schools or community situations don't quite fully appreciate. And at least as one reader, that's what I got from your work. So here's the thing. They know the present realities. They know the political realities in which they live. For instance, a number of kids don't like it when teachers and administrators unfairly and unequally punish people who are involved in some incident, usually the kid of color, as opposed to the white kid. And that begs an issue that there's an attachment, like you were saying, that sociology offers us, that there's something larger going on. And one of the things is, again, returning to this question of how did these kids navigate? And you bring up humor and racial apathy and how these provide a plausible deniability of what's really going on.
Yes. So these are emotions that I saw in the white children who were really happy that Trump was elected. These are sort of like pro-Trump kids. And one of the things that I was really interested to learn about was like the playground games that they were engaging with, the jokes they were telling each other, the costumes that they were, you know, dressing up as. I think in terms of those playground games, you know, there was one. There were some children that told me about this game where, quote, you try to get the Mexican person and they try to run away from you. And so some of the kids are, you know, ICE people, and some of the kids are, you know, and they play these different roles, sort of like a traditional, also, you know, problematic cowboys and Indians kind of mentality. But they're playing this on their school playground. And this is a school that is exclusively white. And so I think it's important to look at these kinds of behaviors in children and not just write it off as like, oh, kids are just being silly, they're just playing a game, but instead really think carefully about what they're doing, how they're processing aspects of the social environment around them. They're trying to make sense of them. They're experimenting with different things.
Media is not far away from them.
Social media is not far away from them. But even just this basic idea of kids playing, this is helping them make sense of like perceived threats that they feel, that they think that their group is, you know, somehow threatened by. And they really, I argue, are about group cohesion. It's about us versus them, you know, and you can see this sort of work, emotional work happening, you know, on a playground where kids are engaging in this type of stuff. So, you know, to your point about taking kids seriously, I always think it's important to like actually take seriously things like play. You know, kids are playing not just to have fun, because that's the work of being a child, is figuring out the social world. And the creation of these jokes and games and other things, I think, are a reflection of how they're processing their emotions about race, how they feel race. And then that's leading them to develop these ideological frameworks or worldviews about how race works. So a lot of the things that the children were saying were about laughter, pleasure, joy. And again, I make a case in this book about the positive racialized emotions of racial dominance. And that part of being able to say, I don't care about racism is, you know, this feeling that I want to be able to just carry on my life and make my jokes and do whatever. And I have, you know, this plausible deny. I don't have anything to do with that. That's not me. At the same time that all of these group boundaries are being created and young people are learning what it means to be a white person and how that means a certain set of things. So anyway, there's a lot more to talk about there, but I guess I've really tried to build on one of my mentor, Tyrone Foreman's concept of racial apathy, and talk about how underlying this apathy is actually a lot more, a lot of emotions around fear, anger, frustration, the idea that, you know, Trump makes emotional sense to these kids in the way that Trump makes emotional sense to some, you know, adults. To many adults. But that's the piece I think that is missing from our larger conversations about how kids are learning all these ideas, is how emotions are coming in and shaping their worldviews.
Yeah, it's an investment of values, but also political actuality of, here are my, I don't think people, particularly kids, sit down and say, here are my privileges, right, I want to preserve them, but they know what goes on. And that brings us kind of, I wouldn't say full circle, but it brings us to another place. First, I just want to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Margaret A. Hagerman, and she's the Associate Professor of Sociology at Mississippi State University. The topic here at We the People, and particularly in this conversation, is children of a troubled time growing up with racism in Trump's America. No doubt that people who've stuck with us for most of the show, Dr. Hagerman, are wondering, what can we do? What can we do? Their parents, their teachers, their active community members. And so we've weaved some of those responses into our conversation thus far. But the bridge that I want to take us on is, you just was talking about their reactions, their feelings, their processing. And it seems to knock down this notion of innocence that's privileged, particularly to white kids in this country, but not privileged to other kids, to kids of color. And so I think one of the, what can we do is to really examine this notion of childhood innocence and how it applies or misapplies to different kids.
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of research that documents this myth of white childhood innocence and how flawed really that way of thinking is. You know, that example I was just giving about kids on the playground, that to me is not an example of white childhood innocence, right? Some sort of like, I don't even know what race is. I don't even think about politics. What my research and others, you know, have documented extensively is that this idea of white kids as being too innocent to learn about history, too, in, you know, we have to protect their innocence somehow, that they can't feel bad. These are the same children who are making statements like, you know, let's drop an atomic bomb on an entire region of the world because we don't like them as white Americans, right? These are children who are violently assaulting their peers of color and using hateful, racist language when they do so. Not all of them, but of course, these are the same kids that we're talking about when we want to ban books and not talk about history and all this stuff. We're protecting this innocence that doesn't, quite frankly, exist. Children are growing up in a society organized and structured by racism. They know about it. They might not have a sophisticated, you know, terminology that you and I do, but they know about it. They feel it. They feel race, and that includes these white children. And so what my research shows, and I mean, this is not just me coming up with some random opinion, this is my data show that these white children already have all kinds of ideas about racism in America. And in many cases, they're perpetrating some of the very harmful ways of thinking. And so, you know, I think one of the things that we need to do is reject this myth of white childhood innocence, not only because it denies innocence to children of color, but also because it just doesn't make any sense. You know, children, every child that I've ever interviewed has all kinds of ideas about racism in America. And every college student, for the most part, that I've ever taught that hasn't been taught the history of racism wants to know more. You know, kids want to know. And I just think that if we take kids seriously as political participants, as members of our society, I know I'm on a rant here right now, but if we take those ideas seriously, then we have to take them seriously. And saying that they're too innocent to know things, I just don't buy it.
Well, that ensues a number of points that you make in your conclusion, but this sense of countering, you know, racist rhetoric or hateful actions, I'm going to say it, maybe not you, it really defies the traditional kind of reactionary response to bullying. Bullying is not, you know, this like pop-up event. It's reflective of the community, that the children are drawing on something to execute the bullying.
Yes, I mean, whatever you want to call it, I think that we need better and earlier interventions that disrupt, you know, the racist rhetoric, these racist behaviors. One of the scholars that I build on her work a lot is Cynthia Miller Idris, and she studies polarization. And her research shows, she studied, for example, she has some research about Germany and the sort of, you know, following the Nazi era and what they did to sort of work with young people. And so she argues about the need to really increase our awareness, even as adults, as educators, you know, when our kids are articulating ideas that fit into this extreme sort of, you know, way of talking and thinking, this propaganda that they are being bombarded with. You mentioned social media before, but there's evidence to suggest that kids are getting these far right, hateful, dehumanizing, you know, ideas that dehumanize entire groups of people. They're getting those ideas from places. And we as adults, I think, need to help them navigate those ideas and be able to help. We need to monitor those ideas, but we also need to give them the tools, critical literacy tools, other kinds of tools, so that they can identify when they are coming up against ideas that threaten a multiracial democracy, which, at least.
And they are doing that. Oh. They are indeed doing that.
Yes. Yes.
You know, just in this week of broadcast with our military to take down a history of Tuskegee Airmen or the women who've served in the military. It sends a signal. It sends a signal to them and to the rest of us. I wonder if you're, I suspect you're going to be asked to produce a new edition of this work or extend your work further. We just have about 2 minutes or so to, what would you say to us now, given just the last few days of activity? I'm trying to imagine again. I'm old enough not to want to go back to ever experience middle school or high school again, and I'm sure there are plenty of adults who feel the same way by observing what their kids are going through. Is there something you want to say about our present moment?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is that the children in this book voted in this last election. They were old. They were old enough to be, you know, for not all of them, but most of them would have just been old enough to vote in this election. And so it's interesting to think about how these ideas that formed a middle childhood, you know, probably informed some of their future behaviors. In terms of doing more research, I'm not sure. I have it in me to do another project specifically about Trump. But I am doing some research right now where I'm talking to traditional age college students about disagreements they have with their parents around politics and, you know, race related current events and things of that nature. I'm trying to understand more about what goes on in families that disagree about all of this stuff.
The kids that you interviewed, they have to literally live this out over many, many years.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So we'll see what the future brings for all of us. But I don't know yet what I'm going to do for my next book.
Okay. Well, thank you for your work and thank you for your time with us. Again, Dr. Margaret A. Hagerman. Dr. Hagerman is Associate Professor of Sociology at Mississippi State University. We've been talking about her book, Children of a Troubled Time, Growing Up with Racism in Trump's America. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, David, and thank you for reading my book.
Well, that does it for this particular broadcast of We the People. Again, I thank you for listening to WPFW. We try to bring you jazz and justice, and we try to build a better world one broadcast at a time. In order to do that, there's not only various programmers, but there's staff members like our engineer Mike Nasella. Thank you for your work this morning and always, Mike. And again, my thanks to the News and Public Affairs Departments of WPFW and to you, the listener, for your support of this station and our programming. All the best to you. Perhaps we'll meet again on the radio sometime soon. Take good care.
The WPFW family mourns the loss of longtime host and producer Larry Applebaum, who passed away peacefully on Friday, February 21st at age 67. WPFW listeners will fondly remember Larry's The Sound of Surprise, which had been a staple of Sunday afternoons from its inception in 1981 until May 2024. An accomplished archivist and internationally recognized jazz scholar, Larry spent his entire professional life at the Library of Congress, serving most recently as a senior music reference specialist in the music division. Larry played a key role in locating the original tapes of a 1957 Carnegie Hall concert featuring Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane. After decades in storage, the recording was finally issued by Blue Note in 2005 to great acclaim. In addition, Larry traveled the world to lecture about jazz and was a frequent contributor to several jazz journals, including Jazz Times and Downbeat. Per his family's request, in lieu of flowers, donations may be made to WPFW at WPFWFM.org or by sending a check to WPFW, P.O. Box 42099, Washington, D.C. 20015. A celebration of Larry's life is in the planning stages. Stay tuned to WPFW for further details as they become available.
Years, WPFW has amplified the voices, told the stories, and shared the history and culture of Black people throughout the diaspora. In short, we are Black history. Black is WPFW. Texting WPFWFM to 801-801 will help to protect this medium in the Black radical tradition so that we can continue to chronicle Black hope, sorrow, and resistance.
Climate Friday host Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr. is but one of the Black voices in climate and environmental justice that will be featured at this year's Taking Nature Black Conference, March 5th through the 8th. Presented by Nature Forward and themed Reclamation and Resilience, with both online and in-person participation for connection, knowledge, inspiration, and more. Details about Taking Nature Black Conference at natureforward.org/takingnatureblack, all one word, Taking Nature Black. That's Taking Nature Black, Reclamation and Resilience, March 5th through the 8th. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Diversity Fund is a grassroots grant source for changemakers of color in the nation's capital. We fund social justice work by and for DC people of the global majority. The deadline for submissions is Friday, March 21st. Details and application information are available at www.diversityfund.org. You can send questions to info@diversityfund.org. Upcoming info session dates and recordings are accessible online at www.diversityfund.org. The phone number for further information is 202-743-0130. That's 202-743-0130.
Hello, I am Von Martin, host of Caribbeana here on Saturdays, 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. on WPFW. For the 48 years I've been on WPFW Radio, I do feel so humbled with the response of you, our listening audience, with your wonderful reaction to our fundraising efforts. On behalf of the staff and management and the volunteers who continue to bring you excellent programming of jazz and jazz extensions with strong public affairs and relevant news, I say thank you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPFW, Washington, D.C.